Good afternoon and welcome to the Hudson Institute. The Hudson Institute was founded in 1967 by strategist Herman Kahn to challenge conventional thinking and help manage strategic transitions to the future through interdisciplinary studies in defense, international relations, economics, healthcare, technology, culture, and law. I am Hussein Haqqani. I am Director for South and Central Asia here at the Hudson Institute and one of the editors of our signature journal, Current Trends in Islamist Ideology. On behalf of Hudson's South and Central Asia program, today I am welcoming all of you and those who are watching on the live stream to the Washington, D.C. launch of Senator Larry Pressler's book, Neighbors in Arms, an American Senator's Quest for Disarmament in a Nuclear Subcontinent. The book is available for sale, the senator has kindly agreed to sign the books for those who would like that. Senator Pressler, who served in the U.S. Senate for 18 years, from 1979 to 1997, is known around the world as the author of the Pressler Amendment, which limited foreign countries from using U.S. aid to develop nuclear weapons. As the Pressler Amendment resulted in shutting down U.S. aid to Pakistan in the 1990s, he was aggressively demonized in Pakistan and by several of my countrymen from Pakistan. I have found him to be a thoughtful American, genuinely concerned about the spread of weapons of mass destruction. So it was important to try and get from him the full story of the Pressler Amendment, along with his views on how mistaken policies have led to the rise of several nuclear powers in the world, including India, Pakistan, North Korea, and possibly even Iran. While in the U.S. Senate, Senator Pressler served as the chairman of the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committees. He was also an active member of the Foreign Relations Committee. And Senator, I learned while preparing for this event that you were the first Vietnam War veteran elected to the U.S. Senate. A graduate of the Harvard Law School, Senator Pressler was also a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University. He has taught or lectured at over 20 universities, including Harvard and the University of California, L.A. He was a Fulbright professor in both Italy and Sciences Po in Paris, France. Welcome to Hudson Institute, Senator Pressler.
Thank you very much.
Let us begin our conversation with the very basic question. How concerned are you about the proliferation of nuclear weapons today?
Well, I consider Pakistan more dangerous than North Korea, in the sense that Pakistan is not under one control of they don't have a centralized control of their nuclear weapons. And it's a country that five or six generals could at any time set off a nuclear weapon or sell one. And indeed, I dream of writing a novel because I guess these policy books don't sell, they sell, but if you're really gonna get your story across, you gotta have a thriller novel that's made into a movie. But people could very easily go to Pakistan, buy five or six nuclear weapons, put them in pickup trucks, haul them out through the tunnels, and haul them over to Vietnam, ship them to Canada, and then bring them into South Dakota across the open border. And
gosh, now let's not get into the fictional work yet, which hasn't been written.
That's right.
Let's just focus. In fact, I would draw you back a little instead of just focusing on Pakistan. Because Pakistan, American officials have acknowledged that Pakistan has a stable command and control system over its nuclear program, and that the U.S. government has often certified that. So is the concern that you're expressing somewhat perhaps more exaggerated or comes from the heart rather than from the facts and the analysis that is available to the U.S. government today?
No, I think the facts are that Pakistan has several nuclear weapons, and had we followed the Pressler Amendment, they would have none, nor do I think India would have any. We had a chance to have a nuclear-free subcontinent, and At the same time, we were effective in the sense that we set a tone that caused Brazil and certain other countries and South Africa and South Korea not to have nuclear weapons. So countries do make decisions. But in some ways, you could say that the United States, our so-called military-industrial state that I call the octopus with all of its law firms and tentacles, actually helped Pakistan get nuclear weapons by going to the Commerce Department for licenses when the Glenn Pressler Amendment, and I want to pay tribute to my late colleague, Senator John Glenn, who was my partner in these efforts on the Pressler Amendment, but also the Pressler-Glenn Amendments, and earlier the Symington Amendment. But the law firms, the big law firms and consulting firms that were hired by Pakistan and India and elsewhere, really were working for the military-industrial state, and they are very expensive to hire. But it seems to me, and you could confirm this, but one of the first things a new ambassador from India or Pakistan has to do is to hire a huge law firm here for $1 million a year and a consulting firm for another million, and they give the campaign contributions and get the access, and they get around what the State Department is doing or what the White House is doing. So our foreign policy is made actually in law firms and in consulting firms, and we need to change that back to. And of course, part of that's because Congress has abdicated its powers. That's another problem that I have. But I consider myself sort of an old-fashioned Eisenhower Republican. I'm now an independent, but I want to be a Republican again if I can be allowed. But I'm for free trade. I'm for nuclear nonproliferation. And remember that Eisenhower made a deal in Korea, and we're going to have to balance some of these interests off and have a rational foreign policy. And I hope that our next Republican platform will have free trade in it as well as nuclear nonproliferation.
Okay, so let's focus on nuclear nonproliferation, which is the subject of your book. And you focused on the subcontinent. Of course, Pakistan is not the only nuclear weapons power. Pakistanis would argue, and I think that would be justified, that they were forced to become nuclear because India went nuclear. And both countries, their nuclear programs in some ways benefited from the Atoms for Peace program in the 1950s. So it was an American assumption that it could actually give to many countries an option of having a nuclear program. And these two countries, because of their particular situation vis-a-vis one another, ended up following nuclear weapons strategies. Many of your critics in Pakistan point out that there's a kind of a discriminatory attitude in your criticism of Pakistan when you do not criticize India for having nuclear weapons. When you authored the Pressler Amendment, did you think that you were actually trying to stop nuclear weapons in the subcontinent, or were you only thinking of stopping Pakistan's nuclear weapons?
Well, I do criticize India also sometimes, but I should thank you, Mr. Ambassador, and I should have started out by thanking the Hudson Institute, but you were the ambassador from Pakistan, and you know Pakistan better than anybody in the world, being from there, and I admire your courage in essentially changing sides, I suppose we could say, but we're so glad to have you here in Washington, D.C. You were here.
I would argue I haven't changed sides. I'm consistent.
That's right.
I'm consistent in my position, but go ahead.
Right. No, but we want to hear from you on Pakistan, because you're the, so for me to be talking. But it seemed to me that Pakistan was dishonest about their objectives, because when I first started working on the Pressler Amendment, some of us believed that Pakistan, what they said, that they didn't want to develop a nuclear weapon. This was back in the late 70s. And early 80s, and John Glenn was particularly upset because he believed them also, and George H.W. Bush believed them, and he eventually enforced the Pressler Amendment, which means that aid and military relationships with Pakistan were shut off until they would stop developing a nuclear bomb, which they kept saying they were doing it. Indeed, the president and the leaders of Pakistan would come to Congress and lie to the entire Congress. Of course, they might not have known. Mrs. Bhutto, she always said, we don't have a nuclear weapon, but it's possible the military never told her because the military, and you would be able to better, she may not have been lying, she may just not have known. So I always had this problem in dealing with Pakistan. Now, India has been more transparent. India reacted, but I think India has also engaged in several steps. For example, they signed the nuclear deal with the United States, knowing full well that unless they had parallel legislation in it for liability, it would never go anyplace. And that's, and I would really like to see India develop peaceful use of nuclear weapons. But so I've been critical of both sides occasionally, but for the most part, on this subject, Pakistan has not been forthcoming, and they have not been a reliable person for us to talk to.
So basically, you criticize nuclear weapons, opposition of nuclear weapons by both India and Pakistan, but are more critical of Pakistan because of what you see as the lack of transparency and dishonesty.
And the fact that there are several groups, it appears to me, that have control of the nuclear weapons. There's not one central place. In the United States, it appears to me that it would take 15 men and women to approve the launching of a nuclear weapon. We think that only President Trump can launch, but he would have to get the concurrence, obviously, of the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the head of the House and Senate as a practical matter, or the President Pro Tem of the Senate and the Speaker of the House. So so we probably have a group of 15 individuals who would have to be involved. In India, I don't know quite what the chain of command is, but I think it's a parliamentary system, so it's very clear. In Pakistan, it's very unclear who's in charge of the nuclear weapons. They say the president is, but we all know that there are several groups of generals who have nuclear weapons, and if they ever got to fighting with each other, it would be a disaster.
Well, we focused a lot of time, which is not what I was planning to do. I was planning to draw you out on the whole story of the book first before we got into this discussion of Pakistan. But since we've already started it, let me just try and kind of summarize it. And I would say that two things. Your concerns seem to be the lack of transparency, what you see as Pakistani dishonesty, and also what you see as Pakistan's internal lack of cohesion, which Pakistanis would, of course, rebut and say that that is not necessarily correct. So let's just stop there on the subject of Pakistan, but let's come to the spread of nuclear weapons. Obviously, the spread of nuclear weapons has been a problem. The Non-Proliferation Treaty was signed assuming that only five countries will continue to possess nuclear weapons, the five major powers that are in the UN Security Council. Since then, India has gone nuclear publicly. Pakistan has gone nuclear publicly. It is believed that North Korea has nuclear weapons. It is believed that maybe Israel has nuclear weapons. Is it realistically possible to go back to a global order in which only those five countries that had nuclear weapons at the time of the signing of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty are the only ones that have it? How do you make somebody give up their nuclear weapons once they have it? Because after all, it does give a country a sense of power, a sense of security. So how do you persuade anybody to give it up?
Well, as a practical matter, you probably cannot. And indeed, we can't roll history back. And my book has got a lot of the history in it, but I do reach conclusions for today. For example, I conclude that we should declare Pakistan a terrorist state, which would put certain sanctions and standards on Pakistan, and we should do that elsewhere where necessary. But you're right that the whole new nuclear order is probably a rather arrogant assumption on the part of the so-called great powers that big countries can have nuclear weapons and small ones shouldn't, and so forth. But they're so destructive that that's the way it's historically evolved. Sometimes we have to play the cards that we are dealt. That's the concept of acceptance. And so we have to go from here forward. And I don't think Pakistan nor North Korea is going to give up their nuclear weapons. But we have to, through the use of sanctions, through the use of all sorts of international pressure, try to have them structure and be transparent enough that we can be sure that some rogue generals will not set nuclear weapons off or something of that sort. And that's really not a perfect answer. I don't have a silver bullet solution to it. I made four recommendations at the end of my book, the one of which was to declare Pakistan a terrorist state, but also I made recommendations for some reforms to treat India at a higher level. And that is, in fact, I think Secretary Tillerson is in New Delhi today doing just that. I sent several copies of my book over to the State Department. They were doing a policy review. I guess we sent eight copies over there for the different agencies. Surprisingly enough, President Trump may be one of the best presidents for India, I mean, in terms of U.S.-India relations that we've had. He and Secretary Tillerson and the Secretary of Defense are advocating closer relationships with India. They're coming close to declaring Pakistan a terrorist state, or at least in effect, and they are very interested in moving toward more free trade with India. Of course, I've been critical of India. They've also got to respond to free trade. So, oddly enough, all the tweets and criticism of the president, he may well be on the road to more nuclear nonproliferation than any president recently.
On this, you know, since you brought it up, isn't engagement a better policy than isolation of somebody, telling somebody that you're a rogue state, you're a terrorist state, might actually put them in a corner, which makes them fight back rather than listen to you, whereas engagement, isn't that what the purpose of the Pressler Amendment was at that time, that instead of shutting off all assistance to Pakistan, make it conditional, because that's what the Pressler Amendment did. It made it conditional that as long as you don't go nuclear, you qualify for assistance, because the original Symington and Glenn amendments said nothing to do with countries, no aid, no assistance to countries that have nuclear weapons programs. So what has made you change from that approach of engagement to wanting isolation?
Okay. Well, the original Pressler Amendment did see, it set some standards, and it wanted to negotiate, and it wanted to for things to be conditional on something. But at some point, when George H.W. Bush came to office, he clearly realized that Pakistan was developing a nuclear weapon, so he enforced the Pressler Amendment. So we had to cut off our military exercises with Pakistan. Citibank had to leave Pakistan. We stopped our USAID programs there. And it was really a shocking thing to Pakistan. And I've sometimes wondered if Pakistan, I'm convinced that had we continued with the Pressler Amendment, they would not have developed a bomb. Now, that's just my judgment. You might give your own, but we...
Senator, they did develop the bomb while the Pressler Amendment sanctions were in place from 90 to 98. So obviously, it didn't deter them, and it didn't stop them. So they just continued still.
Well, I think they had pretty good assurances that the Pressler Amendment was not going to be enforced, certainly not by Bill Clinton, who really went for the top dollar in this whole arena in more ways than one. But that's also in my book. But I believe that they thought that they were getting signals from their lobbyists and lawyers in Washington that the Pressler Amendment was just a temporary thing. It was sponsored by this guy from South Dakota who'd probably go away soon, that's the reason that they insisted on calling it the Pressler Amendment, because they were trying to make it look like it wasn't a part of the administration's policy. This is just a micromanaging by the foreign policy by the Congress, and it will go away. So I don't think, but I think had we really persuaded the Pakistanis that it was going to stay, my judgment is that they would not have continued their nuclear program. But you would probably know the answer to that better than I, because you were there and better able to assess it. But in any event, I think that Secretary Tillerson has and the Secretary of Defense have outlined some conditions on terrorism that Pakistan is not meeting, and if they do not meet those, then we would be justified in declaring them a rogue state. And I know that it's always better to be talking to somebody than isolating them, and as Secretary Tillerson said, we are talking to both the Koreans and the we're talking to both the Koreans and to the Pakistanis through all this, and I hope that that continues.
So North Korea, of course, is a more visible, immediate threat that everybody recognizes. You talk about lack of transparency. North Korea is definitely perhaps the most non-transparent country in the world. Few people know anything about how decisions are made there, how it's governed. Everybody knows that somebody called Kim Jong-un is in charge, but that's about it. How in charge, we really do not know. I mean, why isn't there more of a focus on North Korea's nuclear program in this city than we already see?
Well, I think that the Americans...
They don't even have the octopus working for them. They don't have a lobbyist in Washington, at least none that is visible. And they don't even have an embassy here. So how are they succeeding in getting through whatever they're getting through?
I think they've got China and Russia, and in particular China, who has been very much involved. That is a very good point. They have the Chinese octopus working for them internationally. Let me say that I think in analyzing this whole foreign policy thing, that we have to remember that there are certain international firms that like to export arms, that it doesn't matter who they export them to, nuclear materials and so forth. And they have been in the background in helping both Pakistan and North Korea get nuclear weapons one way or another. For example, John Glenn and I would have a piece of legislation that would prevent the State Department or the Defense Department from exporting certain things to Pakistan, and then the lobbyists would go over to the Commerce Department and get a license for exporting certain types of material or certain patents. So it was like a battle we were fighting, and there were all these big lobbying firms and lawyers and others going about Washington. And Washington is such a vast government. I mean, we have the judiciary, we have the legislative department you can lobby, we have all the agencies that can be lobbied, and it is really hard to keep control of something like nuclear weapons. From our own point of view, we can sometimes become the largest proliferator. We can sometimes become, I'd say the United States is a major proliferator of nuclear weapons in the case of Pakistan and in the case of North Korea, if you really go back to the very beginning. So this is really kind of a scary world, but I hope we're able to reverse that. And I sense that our current Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State are much more attuned to it. President Trump has got, in my opinion, and I'm not speaking for Trump, he has acquired a foreign and a defense policy team that's probably the best we've had in many years.
That's interesting, because you did not support the president.
I did not. I did not vote for him, but I've been. I do write a biweekly column for the Deseret News out in Salt Lake City.
Right.
People are saying, well, are you for Trump? You've been writing a lot of favorable things. Not necessarily favorable. I'm just saying that there are a lot of good things happening in foreign policy and in the Defense Department and the State Department these days.
Okay, that's interesting. Now, let's say 2017, Senator Larry Pressler is back in the Senate. What would you do in terms of legislation today? How would you prioritize the non-proliferation questions? You've expressed concerns about North Korea, you've expressed concerns about Pakistan, we haven't even got to Iran yet. But then there will be second-tier countries, countries who will quietly start having ambitions. North Korea's nuclear program might actually instigate a Japanese or a South Korean ambition, that, you know, how do we compete with these? China's octopus might make Taiwan want to act differently. Pakistan's nuclear program came out of concerns about India's nuclear program. So there are all these international, shall we say, rivalries and threats that could make a large number of countries want to go nuclear. How does Senator Larry Pressler in the Senate today change the discussion about non-proliferation?
Well, first of all, I think that there should be a return to the old, what I say, the old school of Republican foreign policy. That's Eisenhower, Nixon, George H.W. Bush, who believed in free trade, but also in nuclear non-proliferation wherever possible. And this can be achieved through a number of things that, that the government can have. I don't think we can have a set rule. We're not going to be able to take nuclear weapons away from any country, but we can deal with them. I mean, as Eisenhower dealt with the situation in Korea, as Nixon got us into China and had some dialogue. These are generalities, and Democrats do also sometimes. But I really hope that this administration, for example, I don't agree with the anti-free trade rhetoric that's coming out of this administration, but I don't know if that'll be the actual. There seems to be things in actual practice in this administration different from the rhetoric that surrounds it. So I hope that will be the case.
So, in essence, use trade as potential leverage over non-proliferation, that if you want to trade with us, if you have to want to have the economic benefits of being part of the global economic order, then you can't have nuclear weapons or you can't build nuclear weapons. Is that basically
the strategy? And if you do have them, they should be accountable, and you should have a transparent structure in your country that says who's in charge of them, and some safety safeguards in the area of transparency. There are a whole number of things that countries can do besides just trade reward countries that refrain from developing nuclear weapons. And I think that that was the case. Had Brazil gone nuclear, some people think that then Argentina or someplace else might have. And I'm sure that either Venezuela or Cuba would have been, Cuba tried to be. But we have a nuclear-free zone in South America. We should keep that. And we should try where nuclear weapons presently exist. But I wouldn't be so optimistic as to say that we will be, that anybody's going to give them up. I don't think that will happen. But we have to make it clear that we expect a transparent, accountable system.
So, in a way, if we go back a little, because you've described the past, and I commend the book for people who want to understand what happened and how the debate on South Asian nuclear weapons was kind of lost. In case of Brazil, when Brazil didn't, Brazil gave up nuclear weapons, Argentina didn't follow up with nuclear weapons. So in a way, getting Brazil to give up ensured that Argentina also gave up. Wouldn't that also have applied in the South Asian context if India had been focused on, and if India had been stopped from going nuclear? Then it might have been easier to get Pakistan to give up nuclear weapons too?
Yes, well, we certainly urged both countries. It was my understanding that Pakistan was sort of going first on this, or that that was the information that I had, and you might have better information than that. But I believe that if one or the other had stopped going forward, we would have a nuclear-free Asian subcontinent today. The way this went back in the late 70s and early 80s, and that's ancient history, but Senator Glenn and I would continue to offer amendments and make speeches and travel to these countries to try to point out how serious the United States thought that the development of nuclear weapons was and what a disaster it would be for our relationship. Now, the octopus, as I call it, that's the Pentagon and all the arms contractors and all the lawyers and consultants and foundations sometimes who support them would really, I pointed out that I think the Brookings Institute was very much influenced by a lot of contributions that it's got, and we have that in the book here, some of that listed. But in terms of,
I hope you won't make friends at Brookings hate us for having you here.
No.
Okay.
They do a lot of good things also, and
important to say that. Yes.
And in fact, I just read an article by Strobe Talbot on Russia in the Sunday Times. I thought was very good. But Brookings Institute or their leadership, both here and in India, have been major proponents of the U.S. nuclear agreement, without saying that they knew very well that it would not be adopted in either country in so until, unless there were some kind of a liability agreement to begin with. So they were proposing an agreement and have, boasting about it that has no chance of being implemented, in my judgment.
So would you consider yourself critical of the U.S.-India nuclear deal as well?
I'm critical of, I'm glad the two countries have gotten on a friendship basis, but I think it's a false promise. I'm really for developing peaceful nuclear energy in India and Pakistan or any other place. But this agreement was dead at the very beginning. It was much praised and signed and people prancing about and so forth. But there's no chance of it being implemented, in my judgment, because the liability issues have not been addressed, and it hasn't been worked through. Another thing about the formulation of foreign policy, it has to kind of come from the people upwards to some extent. And support of Rotary groups for the Marshall Plan, of Rotary groups, of churches, of different institutions across the country, it's important that a groundwork be laid. We saw what happened with Woodrow Wilson when there was no groundwork laid for the treaty after World War I. But this U.S. nuclear agreement is the same way. There was no groundwork done in India or the United States with the group. There were lobbying and law firms that pulled it together and then had it signed with much accord, but there's nothing to it, really, if you look into it. It's more of an arms sale agreement. President Obama's last trip to India was an arms sale trip, and the poor people of India have to pay for all of these new arms that their country is buying from the U.S., and this is really kind of but it's a new friendship, we're told. But we have to be very careful. I'm surprised, I'm somewhat critical that India has accepted that on those terms.
Tell us more about the book. What made you write it at this point? It's been a few years, almost 20 years since you left the Senate. Surely it didn't take 20 years to write it. You just decided a few months ago that this is a story that needs to be told. So why at this point, and what were you feeling, what were you thinking? Share that with our
audience. I think it was some of the immediate news from Pakistan, from North Korea, and elsewhere that the nuclear...
Iran,
you name it, yes, the Iran. This nuclear thing is becoming more and more the thing that might end the human race. So I have kind of a passion to get this out there, how serious this is and how much we need to talk about it in our campaigns and in our party platforms and so forth. And I would love to see a renewed Republican grassroots effort in foreign policy for free trade and for nuclear nonproliferation and a number of other things, because the Democrats really can't do it because of their union base. So I think that there's a great opportunity here for leadership. But I also feel strongly that somehow the message has to get to people, Pakistan in particular, how dangerous this is. Now, we think of North Korea as being more dangerous. The only reason that we're really immediately concerned about North Korea is that they maybe will develop a long-range missile that could strike the United States. But I would say that Pakistan's nuclear bombs, which are scattered around Pakistan, somebody could go up there with so many million dollars in cash and buy so many small nuclear weapons, haul them out in a pickup trucks and go through tunnels so they're not detected, haul them across land to Vietnam, as I said,
how do you do that? I mean, you have to go through across all of India, et cetera, to Vietnam. Yeah, to go to Vietnam. You mean Afghanistan rather than Vietnam, surely, in geographic
terms. No, drive. It'd be a long drive, but you can drive from...
across the land. Okay.
You'd have to drive across China, probably, but yes. Very easy. You'd bring along your lunch.
Surely China is far more controlled, etc. So you need to work on this scenario a little more in greater detail.
Well, you can help the novel.
We'll talk about that later. But my point is, what do you say to those who say you have, partly because of the reaction that you faced at the end of the Pressler Amendment, and that this is less about nuclear proliferation, and it's become more about Pakistan for you, that you're anti-Pakistan. Do you sense that, or how do you answer those people who say that as your criticism?
No, it's not true. I like both Pakistan and India. In fact, at Oxford, I had two friends when I was there in 1964. I had a few more than two, but two in particular. One was Waseed Sajjam, who became president of Pakistan. The other was Mantak Singh Ahluwalia, who became the chief planner for India and the World Bank representative and so forth. So, and I've always liked both of them, but the Pakistani government was just deceptive to those of us who would go over there to visit with them and to have a direct dialogue. The Indians were much more open and straightforward, in my judgment.
Okay. Well, I think we are sort of on that note ready for questions from the audience. Just raise your hand. I will point at you, identify you, and then one of our friends and our interns will bring you a microphone. So let's start right here in the front. Do stand up, do speak in the mic, do introduce yourself.
My name is Vijay Saswal. I'm a nuclear scientist by profession, now retired, and was involved as a State Department advisor and for the U.S.-India Business Council on the U.S.-India nuclear deal. So since you made some comments about that, I was going to mention two things, one where you're right and one where you're wrong. Where you're right is that indeed the U.S.-India nuclear civil nuclear agreement provided a stepping stone for the octopus to build up on the defense deals. That's a fact. But you're wrong in saying that U.S.-India nuclear deal is dead because it didn't have any legs. We spent a lot of time working it out. Now, why has it not gone? You have a misplaced notion that it's liability. Liability issue has been resolved long time back. But American companies are still arguing for that. Why? Because they cannot sell the power from a nuclear power plant. American nuclear power plants are expensive. We cannot sell them. And American reactors have not been sold overseas for decades. So we are in a position where we cannot be competitive on the global marketplace. Unfortunately, there's always that colonial outlook. You beat on country because you cannot tell them the truth, that we are not able to sell you at the price that you want. So U.S.-India nuclear deal indeed is a very noble and a path-breaking gesture. The challenge for us Americans is to come back in companies and be able to think innovatively so that we can compete on the global marketplace to sell the power from those companies. But yes, it did provide a stepping stone for the other people. That was my comment. I'll share that with you. Thank you.
I thank you very much. That's good information. And I'd like to talk to you some more about that, because are the French able to supply nuclear power plants at a lower cost? Well, then why don't we let the French do it? That would be my reaction.
Have a situation because their own internal industry, the French company used to be called Areva, which, by the way, was my employer for many years. They have been subsequently reorganized because they sort of also could not compete in the global marketplace. They have been essentially fractured in many companies, and EDF, the French nuclear utility, has taken over the part of the nuclear negotiations with India. And those negotiations have gone fairly extensive, but they have to be revised because the previous employer was, French company was Areva. So they have issues essentially dealing with the same, which is that reactors that are supplied by Western reactor companies do not at this time have enough structure within their companies, within their countries, that they can actually take benefit of the economies of scale and be productive. So we are at this time, in fact, I'm very much involved in the U.S. under the new administration, we actually have a situation where we are trying to revitalize nuclear power. And it is my hope that perhaps Westinghouse will sign nuclear reactor deal with India after it gets resorted out of the bankruptcy before the end of the year.
I would suggest a conversation between the two, if you accept.
Absolutely, I would like to.
For the general audience, this is what in the teenage speak of these days, it's called TMD, too much detail. So, okay, the young lady here.
Thank you so much. My name is Aisha Chaudhry. I'm here from Pakistan. So, yeah, as Haqqani Saab said, I do see a bias, though I came here today to see, to listen to you and see if there was something that I had in my mind which was not true and I would feel otherwise. I am a part of a political party there, and I, Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf. So I am the younger lot of politicians that are coming out, and we are the people you'll have to deal with. And after today's conversation, one of the things that I'd like to say is that the sanctions are really not working on us. If you think that declaring us a terrorist state or putting more sanctions on us, none of that is going to work on us anymore. We need to actually, we will start looking the other side, and that is a choice that you are making, not us. So please choose otherwise if you want us to choose you.
Yes. Well, let me emphasize that I'm not just anti-Pakistan. Someone wrote that I was, but because through the years, I have been an advocate of many things for both India and Pakistan. I'd love to see there be peace. And I feel that I've been a little bit critical of the present BJP government in India for fear that it will not treat the Muslim minority correctly. And I was just in the south of India, and my book tour that I just made, I'm just back from India, having had stops at bookstores in New Delhi and Mumbai and Chennai. And there are several other minorities in India who feel that they are not being treated well. Well, that's true. Of course, our own country has a great problem. We have problems. All countries have problems. But I think that the United States and India and Pakistan can do pretty well economically, but we just can't tolerate any more the looseness that Pakistan apparently has in terms of a central control, and that their elected officials are not in the chain of command of their nuclear deployment. Things like that cause me a lot of, and you would not agree with that, probably.
I will not.
Yeah. Well, I think you should just agree to disagree. And secondly, but I would say to a young Pakistani, not just you, Pakistanis are also living in a narrative that is purely Pakistani. I think you should pay attention to what the senator said, that while he started out by being critical of the nuclear program of everybody, it was Pakistan's repeated inability to keep the promises that made him particularly critical. Now, I'm a Pakistani too, and I would say that there is some merit to that argument, whether Pakistanis want to recognize it or not. We have a tendency to overpromise and then later on give excuses for why we couldn't keep our promise. That's not just in relation to the nuclear issue. We've seen that over Afghanistan in the last two decades. So we also need to learn something out of this whole equation instead of just repeating things that we have repeated for many years without any effect. This is a critical moment in U.S.-Pakistan relations, and perhaps finding middle ground is more important than just sticking to old talking points. Yes, sir.
Senator, thank you for coming. My name is Mitsuo Nakai, Japan native U.S. citizen. You mentioned Pakistan is more dangerous than North Korea. Can you expand or clarify what you meant? That's number one. Number two, what could we offer North Korea in order for them to come to the negotiation table, if it's possible? Thank you.
Well, I think that we need to feed the ego of this North Korean dictator. And one way to do it, I've just read in the papers the last few days, is that former President Carter has apparently offered himself as the sort of the president's envoy. Maybe he could go over there and sit down with him and make him feel important or whatever. Jimmy Carter has done a lot of good things, and maybe he could. I think what North Korea needs is just a lot of attention and hand-holding. Now, with Pakistan, it's a different thing because you don't really have one person in charge. I think Pakistan is more dangerous to the United States, and I don't think their weapons are going to be used against India. I think they're going to be gotten out of Pakistan. So, I don't want to get on the details of driving a pickup, but maybe they'd be flown in an airplane or sent in a boat, or we'd figure out some other way to get them. But their weapons could be transported to the United States fairly simply, And just as 9/11 was a very simple operation run by 20 or 30 people, so could getting a if you gave somebody enough cash, you could, somebody, I said, well, you could pay the generals so much to get the nuclear bombs or some. Someone else said, well, you could buy it from the colonels because they've got keys to get the nuclear bombs out, and you could get a lot cheaper. But in any event, that could happen. So the Pakistani nuclear bombs are not controlled. They're subject to sale or stealing, and they could be easily gotten out of Pakistan to just about anywhere in the world. And I used a pickup truck as an analogy from my proposed movie, which Vin Roque is here. He's going to write the movie script.
Gosh, so we already have a movie announcement, which was not the plan today. Right at the back.
Senator, I'm Group Captain Ali. I'm there at the Embassy of Pakistan, and I have a question with three parts. I'll not make any comments. First is, since you have talked about this novel and probably going through the Pakistan and other things, how do you justify at least 3 to 4 occasions where in a USAF C-17, parts of nuclear weapons were shipped to a USAF base where they remained there for over 1 week unattended? And I've done AWA College for Montgomery, Alabama, so I know all those details. How do you justify that? Secondly, would it be appropriate for you?
Can we go one at a time? So United States Air Force losing or...
Not
or,
losing, or unattended, being there at least thrice on a USAF base, parts of those nuclear weapons.
And if I may try and interpret the group captain's question, it basically is that so far, Pakistan has never had such an incident. So the U.S. has occasional question. Everybody talks about Pakistan's loose nukes, but the Pakistanis proudly point out that we haven't had any nuclear incidents or accidents of the kind that you have had. Good. Isn't that the correct interpretation?
Exactly.
Thank you.
Well, we've got Carlton Stoiber, the leading nuclear legal expert in the world, sitting in the audience, so he could probably cite some examples. But I would say that there have probably been a lot of examples that we don't know about in all countries. And that's one of my problems with a lot of nuclear weapons floating around. That's why I was interested in nuclear nonproliferation as part of my career. And out in South Dakota, where I come from, I guess the Pentagon wants to refresh some of the warheads. I thought we were removing them under the Nunn-Lugar agreement. But yes, if there are a lot of nuclear weapons around, there are going to be incidents, some incidents of, where they're dangerous or one could go off.
So basically, you would say that all nuclear weapons are bad, whether they are American nuclear weapons or anybody else's. And
well, that's what I would feel.
The end game should be to get rid of all nuclear weapons.
Well, that would be the ideal ending. But I'm also a pragmatist, and I think that we have to accept that to get better control and more transparency and more chains of command. But I think the United States chain of command on its nuclear weapons is quite good.
Okay. Group Captain, second point.
The second is, so how do you justify trying to control other countries and reducing their nuclear weapons? While you were talking about the octopus and the military-industrial complex, isn't it time for the U.S. to look inwards and try to clean up own house? Because it's the U.S. administration which is letting this happen. So why isn't the U.S. doing something inwards rather than pointing fingers outwards towards other countries?
Well, we should be doing much more, and we do need weapons reform. In fact, we're building a lot of weapons, not only nuclear weapons, but other weapons that I don't think make us any stronger. I don't think we should launch any more carriers. We've got, I think, 12 or 13 or 14 operational ones, and no other country in the world has really got any operational ones that I know of. And the same thing is, as the Secretary of Defense testified before Congress, and they said, why don't you cut spending over there at the Pentagon? He said, well, we try to eliminate several lines of weapons, and the Congress keeps restoring them under our lobbying law firm, consulting firm type of making foreign policy and making defense policy. We do have a new Secretary of the Air Force from South Dakota, Heather Wilson, who is president of the University of South Dakota School of Mines. But I hope she's able to slow down a little bit, although I have not any indication that she is trying. But the Air Force in particular is from Ellsworth Air Force Base on is just into a great expansion mode, and I don't think it makes us any stronger unless we're building these weapons to offset a particular threat.
Third one, you said three questions, and I've given you three.
Thank you very much. The last one is, would it really be appropriate to categorize Pakistan and North Korea on the same page?
Yes, I would, from a nuclear dangerous point of view, and I think that they are both rogue states, in my opinion. They both do not have the interests of the United States in mind. Pakistan has and is harboring terrorists, and North Korea is a threat to the United States. But I'm one of those persons, I think, like in the Eisenhower-Nixon philosophy, you have to sort of accept things as they are and try to work from there. I think that North Korea can be, we're just going to have to deal with the situation. We really don't have military options in North Korea, because even if we destroyed them nuclearly, they would still have enough conventional weapons to destroy Seoul and South Korea. And so we really don't have a military option when you really come down to it there. And that's why I'm a little worried about some of the presidents of both parties' strong statements. And those kind of statements probably shouldn't be made unless we're going to follow through with them.
Good. Okay, so a couple more questions here in the middle, then I'll move to the Doug there. Right, the gentleman in the, is it a brown shirt or a whatever the color is.
Thank you, sir. This is Ahmed Khan from National Defense University. I'm currently on a research tour in Washington, D.C. I have a question to Senator Pressler that some of the critics in Pakistan believe that your language of amendment was so vague that it actually helped Pakistan to build its nuclear weapon. And secondly, I was reading, going through a literature on from the Cold War era. It suggests that the peripheral states were, you know, supplied with the arms by the core state to increase the level of hostility between the regional rivals, and also as a vehicle to pursue their own interests. So in the whole talk, I unable to understand that what was the American interest in supplying arms during the Cold War era to Pakistan. Thank you, sir.
So, what was the U.S. interest in supporting or supplying weapons to Pakistan during the Cold War?
Yes, well, yes, that was his second question.
And the first one was that the language of the Pressler Amendment was so vague that it actually enabled Pakistan.
Yes, let me answer that first one in the order. The language was not so vague. That is an argument that is used especially by some from some of the Pakistani intellectuals, saying that it was a bogus thing to start with. That's not true. John Glenn made a very powerful speech rebutting that. Actually, this was the Pressler-Glenn Amendment, and the Pentagon would always call it Pressler Amendment because they wanted to make it sound like it was by some rogue senator out there, and John Glenn was so famous they didn't want to put his name on it because they didn't want to give it any more credibility. But a little bit more of history. Now, to say that I am automatically anti-Pakistan, as this amendment lays out. At first, Pakistan supported the Pressler Amendment. Now put that in your pipe and smoke it. At first, Pakistan supported the Pressler Amendment. Their lobbyists were called Neal and Company, and they were up there around the Foreign Relations Committee advocating for the Pressler Amendment because Pakistan said that was their official position. We don't have a nuclear weapon. We don't plan to develop one. And we got no problem with the Pressler Amendment. In fact, the first Pressler Amendment, Jimmy Carter had shut off aid to, this is arguing about ancient history, but had shut off aid to Pakistan, and they saw it as a way of restoring aid to Pakistan. Some did. So to say that this Senator Pressler is just against Pakistan, Pakistan was for the Pressler Amendment. So put that into your brain, deep into your brain when you're discussing the Pressler Amendment, because it isn't just automatically a negative. It was a true non-proliferation effort that had a great following and a great, and Ronald Reagan strongly supported it. And I was a personal friend of Ronald Reagan because of our discussions about Alzheimer's disease and so forth and a whole bunch of other things. But Ronald Reagan personally supported the Pressler Amendment, as did George H.W. Bush. And I have a feeling that those two presidents were two real Republican foreign policy presidents who did a good job. But in particular, George H.W. Bush, there was no question in his mind but to enforce the Pressler Amendment and support it completely, which he did. And of course, Bill Clinton, the very first thing he did was to dismantle it when he came into office as much as he could. And that is the difference in the two political parties' approach to things. And we've got to get back to the old-fashioned Republican foreign policy school. And I may rejoin the Republican Party if we can.
The gentleman, and then, right? The second question was what? I mean, obviously, you are critical of the octopus, but part of the reason why the octopus flourishes is because sometimes U.S. strategic sort of approaches result in situations like arming Pakistan. So why did the U.S. arm Pakistan during the Cold War?
Well, I'm sure part of it was because we fell into this trap of trying to reward them for taking all the refugees and thinking that it's just false thinking when you embrace a country that has been very false to you as a temporary ally. It never works up, and it certainly has not.
Okay.
Yes, I see
the Tim
White's
right behind him.
Yes.
My name is Tim White. I'm with the Spectrum Group in Alexandria, and I am a retired U.S. Air Force general officer. And to my friend, I would point out that when there were violations of the chain of command that resulted in nuclear incidents that you refer to, heads rolled. They're gone. So there is an accountability. It needs to be improved, as the senator pointed out. But, Senator, your book and this discussion, first of all, congratulations on walking into the lion's den. You've done a fine job here.
This is the line.
That was going to be my line.
That was your line. I'm sorry to steal your line.
End the morning. Come on.
I'm so sorry to steal your line. Nevertheless, the book and this discussion have focused really on proliferation and non-proliferation issues as you apply them to what you see as the vulnerabilities of Pakistan's command and control over its nuclear weapons arsenal. If you move to the title of your book and that we see on the screen, Disarmament on the Nuclear Subcontinent, or Nuclear Disarmament on the Subcontinent. Can you imagine, Senator, a situation in which India and Pakistan would see it in their mutual interest to have bilateral non-nuclear military forces? De-escalation, elimination bilaterally because that would solve the proliferation issue, wouldn't it?
That is a stroke of genius. I would love to see something like that considered. There are a lot of areas that India and Pakistan agree on, and they have, in my opinion, I can never tell the difference in the people, and I know there's the religious thing and so forth, but they have so many common interests that which are probably against China in the long run, although free trade there would be a great boon to all of them. But that's an area where India has to do much more. That's where I've been critical of India on some occasions. Is that they don't practice free trade as much as they would like other countries to do so. But it would be great to have some bilateral disarmament in our old world, and that would be a great place to start. And also India and Pakistan could have joint forces for certain purposes, whatever that might be. And there's a whole area for thinking here that we just seem to be locked into an old mentality, and I hope we can break out of it. And I hope my book will make a little bit of a dent in that. And I've had a very good book tour in India. I went to 3 Indian cities, and my book is doing pretty well in India, and I hope it'll do well in the United States after today's launch at the Hudson Institute.
I'm sure that it'll also do well in Pakistan. People would
want to read it,
although many will be critical. But that's how discussion moves forward, by having opinions and ideas that are not necessarily, if everybody starts off with agreement, you just hug and go to sleep. Question right there.
Doug Johnston with the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy. Thank you both for a very engaging discussion. One thought I had, Senator, that causes me to think that you should be every bit as concerned about North Korea as you are Pakistan. And that is because the leader has gone on record that the nuclear weapons are not negotiable. and one can easily understand why he would take such a position. If that's the case, I doubt seriously that we should be fearful of a direct attack from there. But it seems to me that the more they're backed into a corner, and particularly if China's on board, he's going to have very few options, one of which is probably at least semi-lucrative, would be selling this technology to terrorists. I think I'd be very concerned about that.
Well, I thank you very much, and I thank you, your group. I know religions and churches and synagogues have played a great role in the formulation of domestic policy and foreign policy in the United States in a very positive way. I know the Presbyterian Church, I just read their National Council has adopted some kind of a resolution regarding the Middle East, but I'm not going to go there to say what it is. But the point is, Catholic Relief Services or our various communities have a tradition of being active in foreign policy, and we should listen to them and hear them out. Of course, we can't always follow everything that they might suggest, but and I might say that your friend Taylor Keelan, who helped me with this book so much, is here today, and I've been meaning to find an excuse to thank her, but she, I think, brought you today. So I don't know if I've made a statement here, but I don't know if I've responded to the question.
The question is that, you know, he's just pointed out all the reasons why we should be concerned about North Korea as well.
Yes.
And
yes,
very
yes.
Seriously.
And I appreciate that very much. I would put them both about on an equal plane. But I personally believe Pakistan is more dangerous to us.
Okay. I think Mr. Johnson's point was that North Korea is equally, if not more, is how I understood it. Last two questions. Were you raising your hand, sir? Yeah. Yeah.
I had always understood that India's primary motivation for going nuclear was not a worry about Pakistan, because militarily India is so much more powerful than Pakistan conventionally. I don't think India had a real fear of Pakistan that drove that decision. I always understood it was China. China is always hostile and adverse towards India. Wasn't that what drove India primarily to go nuclear? And if so, why would India ever think of giving up nuclear weapons with China on their back door?
Well, that's a very good point. And some people say that China is building that big road across China and Pakistan and on the new Silk Road. But I say it's economic development, and that's good. And China is doing some economic development projects in Africa, and some people say, oh, they're. I say that's good for the people of Africa and for economic development. So I'm not just a flat-out critic of China, but I don't think China wants to go to war with India. It doesn't. It couldn't possibly rule a single Indian state. The people there are so independent, and. I just don't think that China is as dangerous as some people say it is. China is a very controlled, their weapon system is very controlled. They also have a very healthy economy, and they're getting rich and getting more cars and all that. So I don't see that, but I think that Tom Patton, the lawyer here, he makes a very good point. But in my mind, I don't think India would have gone nuclear if they hadn't seen Pakistan doing so.
Okay. Although that Tom's point was that it was probably more directed at China, so that question still remains unanswered. I think we still have a problem. Like, as long as there's somebody who has nuclear weapons, somebody else will want to have.
Yes.
Them.
Yes. And we're in a real world as a practical matter. Yeah. Nobody's going to give up their nuclear weapons.
Yeah. So. Let's club these two questions to bring it to an end. Mr. Vasti here, and yeah.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. I'm Iftikhar Hossain. I work for Voice of America. Thank you for the discussion, Ambassador Haqqani and you, Larry Pressler. I have two questions. Number one, can you just describe us the scenario that the Pakistani nuclear weapons can be transported to the United States? This is what you mentioned.
I think that's already happened. We've already gone through. So I'm going to disallow that question. Go on, ask.
And also, the second question is, don't you think the U.S. priorities before the Pressler Amendment may have overlooked the possibilities that Pakistan is building nuclear weapons, and it was a, leak on part of the U.S. It was not Pakistan, but more on the U.S. policy.
Basically, the U.S. ignored what was really happening.
Or its own interest.
There are people who thought that the war in Afghanistan was more important, and you know what's happening with Pakistan's nuclear program is less important. And could that have been the reason why eventually the Presley Amendment had to be invoked? And this gentleman here, so we can have all the questions, remarks, and then we can have final comments.
My name is Suleiman Wasti. I'm a student of the Middle East and a friend of Larry, and also Mr. Haqqani. Just a correction, Larry. I'm not too concerned about the command and control of the Pakistan's nuclear arsenal. I'm more concerned about the rogue nuclear scientists like A.Q. Khan, the most revered guy, like the father of Pakistan bomb. The second one is Qadri. I don't want to mention him. But those are the people who are peddling all these technologies to countries of the Middle East and others. That's my major concern, and I would like you to take note of it in your sequel.
Pakistani nuclear scientists who might go rogue rather than the Pakistani state going rogue. That's that's the more important. So both these things.
Okay.
Americans drop the ball. That's the first one. And rogue nuclear scientists, the second.
Okay, and I can't avoid going back to my thriller movie in which a weapon. You could put one in a crate and get it inside one of those transport planes that are flying in and out of Afghanistan every day or Pakistan, but somehow you could do it. So I think it's very dangerous to the United States.
Now let's not try and rehearse that for the movie. So okay. that could have that could have consequences itself.
Yes,
but yeah.
I'm trying to think back, but
America dropped the ball on the nuclear program because of Afghanistan.
Yes. Well, it was a fascinating thing to me with President Ronald Reagan, and I did know him personally. More so than a lot of other people did. And he was very much for the Pressler Amendment concept. But I think in his second term, he was not paying as much attention to detail. And his staff did some end runs. That's another thing about Washington, D.C. The lawyers and lobbyists and the staffers working with the guys in the Defense Department and in the second and third level staffers can do a lot of things. And they kind of undid the Pressler Amendment. But also, Ronald Reagan, I think he got very bad staff advice, or he just signed off on the certification. Because it was different from what he said to me, and I discuss this in my book. It's very confusing to me as to how that came about. But yes, I suppose you could say that the U.S. government did turn a blind eye to because of the situation in Pakistan.
In Afghanistan,
yes, in Afghanistan.
And Mr. Wasti's comment about rogue nuclear scientists?
Well, I certainly would worry about them also. And in Pakistan, it appears to me that there's less control over the nuclear community, and there are five or six centers of the nuclear community in Pakistan. Whereas in India, they really have got the thing, they really appear to have the thing tied down to one chain of command. And I believe we have things tied down to one chain of command in the United States. And as General White pointed out, heads did roll when that nuclear mistake was made. So it was made, recognized, and a few people got fired over that.
Well, thank you very much for an interesting conversation. We are not all going to agree on everything, but a wonderful book here with some historic insights, which people don't always have to read to agree, but to learn from. So a wonderful book, Neighbors in Arms, and a big thank you to Senator Larry Pressler, as well as to all the lobbyists and lawyers in the audience who took quite a bit from both of us today. Well, thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.